I'd like to call this meeting to order, the joint meeting of the Committee on Public Health and Housing Policy and Higher Education and Workforce Development. And thank everybody for being here. The reason for our meeting today is to talk with people at the Health Department who are working with us on the mesothelioma issue. They issued a press release, I guess it was March 28th. This is our first opportunity to kind of talk about that, understand what the proposed studies are. And then the other part of this hearing really is to look into the issue of work-related and occupational data as it relates to cancer and whether that's a valuable part of our cancer registry and our cancer research here in the state of Minnesota. So the first thing that we would like to do is just to hear from the Health Department about what their plans are, what they wanted us to know when they handed us this release, and to talk about where this is going in terms of what's already happened in previous studies and plans for the future. And we have some of the folks here who will be talking with us who are most impacted by that cancer and by that problem, and who will hopefully be part of the dialogue we have this morning. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mary Manning, Minnesota Department of Health, the Division Director for Health Promotion and Chronic Disease. As you know, respiratory issues have long been a major concern in the northern eastern part of our state. For a decade or more now, that part of the state has recorded unusually high rates of mesothelioma, a relatively rare fatal form of respiratory cancer associated with asbestos exposure. Some of the mesothelioma cases reported in that area can be explained by occupational exposure in the manufacturing facility that once operated in the Cloquet area. However, that one source of occupational exposure doesn't account for the high elevations in mesothelioma rates. What's more, the increase has occurred only in men, which suggests that the illness is occupationally related. Understandably, there has been an ongoing concern about the possible health risks involved in mining work. At the same time, there are also long-standing concerns about the general environmental impact of the wastes that are released by the mining processes of taconite. There are unresolved scientific questions about the health impact of the mineral fragments found in taconite waste. Are they truly as dangerous as asbestos, and if not, how dangerous are they? If we were to regulate these materials effectively, we need a clearer picture of the risks involved. So we are planning two new studies. The studies both will be done by the Minnesota Department of Health with partners. One of the studies will represent the next phase of a study that we completed about 4 years ago. That study focused on a group of 72,000 former mine workers originally identified by the University of Minnesota who had worked in the Minnesota mining industry between the 1930s and 1982. We were able to identify 17 people in that group who had been diagnosed with mesothelioma, and we attempted to determine what might have placed them at risk for that disease. That earlier investigation was limited in scope and focus, and the conclusions were modest. We concluded that the most likely factor placing these individuals at risk was the exposure to commercial asbestos through their work activities. Commercial asbestos is used in connection with activities that are not just unique to the mining industry. They include things like plumbing, carpentry, boiler operation, and maintenance work and other types of activities. In that report from 4 years ago, we did also acknowledge that there were many unanswered questions. Since that time, we have identified 35 additional cases of mesothelioma from that original 72,000 group of mine workers, bringing the total now to 52. Those additional cases raise new concerns, and we are proposing a new study to address those concerns. The new study will differ from the earlier ones in two important ways. First, the new study will look at possible previous exposure of workers to taconite dust, as well as their exposure to commercial asbestos. The new study would also use a case control approach. That means we'll be comparing mine workers who develop mesothelioma and determining what, and comparing those with mine workers who didn't develop the disease, and determining what aspects of the mine work might have placed those workers at risk. This is going to be a very challenging project, but we believe it's a very important one. Questions about mining work and respiratory health have been in play for many years, and we believe this study will provide some answers. Reconstructing what happened in the past and determining what activities these workers participated in is not an easy task. We anticipate that the study will take up to 3 years to complete, and once we finish the we believe that we will take, it'll take about 3 years. We plan to seek federal funding, which will cost at least $750,000 or more. And I'm going to let that, that's all I have to say about the first study, and then John Stein is going to talk about the second one.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee.
John Stein, I'm the Director for Environmental Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. The second study that Ms. Manning is referring to is a risk assessment study using available data to evaluate cancer risks associated from environmental exposure to mineral fragments on taconite wastes. And we've got data that is been collected and analyzed previously by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and we are awaiting receipt of that data that would provide us with the basis for this study. What the study will do is look at a model, developing a model for assessing and protecting the public from any risks that might be associated with the waste from mining or ore processing activities. The new model will allow us to develop scientifically sound, health-based regulatory limits for exposure to these materials. And what's more than that, the regulatory numbers will be site-specific, taking into account the specific types of mineral fragments that may be present at a particular location. As you know, or you may not know, the mineral fragments that result from crushing activities vary in their type of mineral, the composition of the mineral, the length and the width of the mineral itself, the fragments that break off from those minerals. The model that we've developed will give us a stronger basis for making regulatory decisions about exposure to taconite waste. We estimate that the fiber study, the risk assessment study that we're talking about here, will be completed within approximately a year of our receipt of the data from the EPA, a cost of about $250,000. And this is the conclusion of our testimony this morning. We will be available to answer questions, but we are interested in better understanding respiratory illness and mining waste and the history on the Iron Range in Minnesota. And we believe that these two new studies will help us address some of those concerns.
Thank you, Dr. Stein. Questions from committee members?
Dr. Stein.
Chairman Rickman.
You've made the application for the federal funding, or are you in the process of doing that?
I'll let Ms. Manning answer that question.
We're in the process.
So, I mean, what happens if you're refused? Are you going to be coming to the legislature looking for funding as you did in the past?
We don't anticipate. We have been in contact with a number of different federal agencies, and unfortunately this situation is very compelling, and we're very hopeful that we will get federal funding. We want to do the study if we don't receive federal funding, and then we'll take next steps after that.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukovina, the second study regarding the risk assessment, We would pay for out of existing state sources. We're working together with the IRR and MPCA and our department, as well as the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, to evaluate what available funds may be available. If those funds are insufficient, we may seek additional funding, but at this time we don't anticipate that will be needed.
And Madam Chair, Dr. Stein.
Chair Rokudia.
The second study then, you're going to go into the plants themselves and you're going to do the testing for the airborne?
Actually, Madam Chair, Representative Rukovina, the second study is looking at data that's been produced from other studies on different fragments and fiber types and lengths and widths that would evaluate the impact on laboratory animals, and then transfer that through traditional risk assessment processes to apply that to specific mine locations. For example, if we were discussing a specific mine, we would use the modeled information to compare against the fragments that are present in a given mine. So yes, eventually it requires us to have data about the fibers that are present in a given location to set a regulatory standard.
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stein, this study is directed to the northeastern part of the state. My question, I guess, is when a person is diagnosed with cancer, is there a reporting process so that we know we have a record of particularly this type of cancer? You mentioned the number of cases up there in the northeast. Is that true across the state so that we also have a feeling of whether there's other pockets or areas of the state that have a similar, you know, potential problem?
Ms. Manning.
Chairperson, Representative, we actually get reports of all cancers in the state of Minnesota, and that's about 25,000 cases each year, and it's the entire state. So we would know what the rate of mesothelioma was in your area or any other area in the state.
Okay, thank you. Okay. That was my follow-up, but you've already answered this, too. So they do break it down as to the type of cancer in the report.
Yes.
Okay. My follow-up or final comment would be, in the area that I live in, I know of two cases. One was my mother. She had no experience in the mines. She worked as a clerk in a store, a grocery store. That was her only out-of-home work environment experience. And the other was a fellow by the name of Roy Anderson, who was the director of the Lakeland Mental Health Center. Again, so no exposure to mining or to asbestos or anything that that you can recollect as you think back in their life, but still, you know, they died of the same disease.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, in the case of mesothelioma, it's okay, Chairperson, Representative, in the case of mesothelioma, the exposure to asbestos doesn't have to be long and ongoing. Unfortunately, it can be a just transient exposure, and that's what's very difficult about this disease.
Thank you.
Representative Norris, one thing I would point out to you, though it's a big concern to mine, there is nothing in our cancer registry right now that would ask where your mother ever worked. We do not collect occupational data, and we don't. I think we'll hear some testimony that we don't even always collect it to any meaningful regard on the death certificate. But, you know, I think, Ms. Manning, you'd have to correct me if I'm wrong, but right now, on our anyone who has mesothelioma or any other cancer right now, there is not on our cancer registry at the state of Minnesota, even though we've tried to ask for this for a few years in legislation, there is no place on there to record the occupation nor the occupational history. Correct, Ms. Manning?
You're correct. And in the case of Representative's mother, you know, that wouldn't have been actually very helpful to know that she had worked in a grocery store or at home. That's why researchers choose, as we do in Minnesota, across the country, that data isn't collected. Because usually what researchers need to do is to look at the type of cancer that has occurred and then do a special study or an in-depth evaluation. And usually just getting what we do get when we have gotten it voluntarily is information that says the person's retired. or what their last job was. And in that those cases, that isn't very helpful to us. That's why it isn't generally collected around the country. And when we do these types of special studies, we're going back and getting really in-depth information from the families or histories that we might have.
I think you're hearing the opposition. One of the concerns I do have is that dead people can't really tell you a whole lot of information, and it's helpful, I believe, if we have a whole occupational history, and that's what we're, it's one of the things I want to have us talk about here today. But
Madam Chair, just one
of the things.
You know, the other thing, as we look back and try to, you know, solve the mystery, understanding where asbestos can be lurking is kind of helpful.
Okay.
You know?
That's right. When whether or not the store where your mother worked, did they have asbestos in the tile? Did they have things, you know, fall, that fell down? There's all kinds of questions. You know,
the operator smoked cigars very heavily, so she inhaled a lot of cigar smoke, but okay. I mean, it had nothing to do with her cancers.
Okay. Representative Eastman, I believe, had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious. Is this elevated level of this type of cancer? Is this unique to kind of the Iron Range of Minnesota? Are there other places in the country that are seeing elevations of this type of cancer as well? Or what do we know about kind of the more universal?
Nothing to this level. This is unique.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just out of curiosity, could either one of you tell me the difference between asbestosis and I can't pronounce that.
Mesothelioma?
Yeah, that's it.
Ms. Manning? Representative? I actually can't give you the clinical differences of those two diseases. One is mesothelioma is a cancer. Whereas asbestosis, I know, is not. It's another disease that's related to asbestos exposure. But I can't give you a definition of that. I would be more than happy to get back to you with one. Senator Hunter?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. My stepdad was a plumber for years, and he's got asbestosis, but he does have mesothelioma, whatever it is. I had a note from a friend of mine in the Iron Mining Association that pointed out that there was a study conducted before, and Cleveland Cliffs recently contracted a third-party study. Do you know anything about those studies, and is this a duplication of what they're doing? Have you studied the study that has been done?
We will be, Madam Chair, Representative, we are building upon the first study. That first study had only 17 mine workers in it, and all those folks had an exposure to commercial asbestos. We're going to be, in the second study, looking at their exposure, those 17 miners, their exposure to taconite dust, as well as the 35 new cases. We'll look at their commercial asbestos exposure and their exposure to taconite dust. The study that Cleveland Cliffs plans to engage in is a study of their own workers. And I think that's a very good idea, and they're going to be going beyond what we're doing, because we'll just be looking at the issue of mesothelioma. But we're aware of those activities.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I could just add to that, the study that Cleveland Cliffs has announced is at their North Shore mining facility at Silver Bay.
Madam Chair.
John Rocavina.
Members, there's actually been two studies done, and I think the first one was paid for by IRRRB, if I'm not mistaken. And those, whatever information they had, was lost in the flood in the University of Minnesota, where not only the paper was lost, but microfilms, from what I understand, were also destroyed. The second study, Dr. Bender is up here in the audience, and maybe we can get him down just for a second to tell us. I believe we appropriated the money in maybe 99 or 2000 Dr. Bender, as you're coming down, you can refresh our memory and just tell us what you found out then and what your conclusions were and what you intended to do with that information.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina.
Welcome to the committee. If you introduce yourself, please.
My name is Alan Bender. I'm Section Chief of Chronic Disease and Environmental Epidemiology. Let me respond to two statements. First, that wasn't lost in the flood. That is the 72,000-person cohort that the university created. We were able to retrieve that probably about 10, 12 years ago and had been using it for all these activities, including your second question, which was the development of what was referred to as ORDIS, the Occupational Respiratory Disease Information System. And the first activity of developing that respiratory disease system was to look at the issues in northeastern Minnesota, which were threefold, only one of which we're talking today, so I'll quickly summarize the other two. One of the others was to follow that 72,000-person cohort and determine their entire mortality and compare it to the mortality experience of other Minnesotans to look at a number of causes of death, not just cancer. The second concept that was being developed with ORDIS in northeastern Minnesota with the help of the St. Mary's Hospital and the Duluth Clinic was developing a system to identify respiratory disease in an occupational setting on an ongoing basis, similar to what we do for cancer with the Minnesota Cancer Surveillance System. And the third was this study of the relationship between taconite exposure and mining industry and mesothelioma. To conduct the third, we impaneled a group of about 50 people from that part of the state, from academia, from the mining industry, and from labor, as well as other civic and policy makers to help direct that. And the first step of that analysis was to look at something that's called a confounder. In other words, is there something else going on in the mining industry that's related to mesothelioma that we have to account for if we are going to study the relationship between taconite dust and mesothelioma? And the well-established risk factor for mesothelioma is commercial asbestos. So at the direction of the work groups, we developed this protocol. We're in the process of looking at commercial asbestos exposure as the first step of an entire sequence of studies. When the funding for ORDIS was repealed, we were able to limp along and complete this part of it, and we did determine that, in fact, commercial asbestos exposure is related to mining experience and needs to be accounted for in any study of taconite dust exposure. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. And so, Madam Chair, you had anticipated continuing this, and your money ran out, or you got cut, or we got mad at you and took the money away. I can't remember, though, you know, how it actually transpired.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, we are definitely in process of a sequence of steps that we anticipated to be able to complete with the ongoing funding that this system had. I want to make clear, we not only lost the study we're talking about right now, which we intend to continue, hopefully with federal funding, but we lost the other two initiatives as well.
Edwin, when you say you lost those initiatives, could you explain a little bit more what you're talking about?
Meaning the funding to carry them out was repealed, as well as the enabling statute.
And Dr. Bender, when and why was that repealed? Can you share that with the committee?
Representative Clark, Representative Rukavina, committee members, I don't know for sure why. I know when, 2002.
All right, well, maybe we'll be able to get some more information on that as we go along.
I have the citation, I believe, here, if you, that would be helpful, the original language. Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, it is 144.6905.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Ms. Danny.
It was part of Governor Ventura's biennial budget, 2002.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I think what we're going to do is go on and hear from the other witnesses. Please hang around, both of you. We'll probably return to you for some more questions. Thank you very much. The next witness I have is Bob Bratulich. Bratulich? Bratulich. Welcome.
Christina would have no problem with
that. I'm sure. I should have let him call you.
Magara.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Bob Radlich. I'm the director of the Steelworkers in District 11, which is composed of 9 states from Montana to Iowa and Nebraska to Minnesota. Some of the history, as I recall, of the mesothelioma study and the lung issues in northeastern Minnesota actually start back in the late 70s and the early 1980s, when there was a radiologist that was a B reader that was working for the East Range Clinic. And out of, in my recollection, is out of 700 and some x-rays, some 400 showed signs of pleural thickening. And that led the doctor to conclude that there was some respiratory problem going on with that population. Subsequent to that, the IRRB funded a study on mortality and morbidity based upon those people in that 70,000 work group that had worked in the mining industry over the years from 1930 to 1982 or 1983, I believe. That study, as far as I know, was never concluded, the results of which I certainly have never seen. And I don't know of anybody else that has seen those results. And as we were going forward, and as the Minnesota Department of Health is going forward with the third study, or the second study, I guess, we looked for those records through the IRRB and found them at the University of Minnesota. And it was my understanding then that some of those records had been damaged because of water that had gotten into the basement, and some of them were unreadable and unusable, and all of that data was not recoverable. So we move into the early 2000s and end up with the study at the Minnesota Department of Health, of which I was a member of that committee in northern Minnesota, along with some of my colleagues. It was clear to us being those on the union side, that this was going to be a very limited study and was only going to deal with commercial asbestos and was not, in fact, going to look at airborne fibers in the industry that could, in fact, cause mesothelioma, in our view, or cause some other respiratory cancers. That clearly is what the study came out to be. It was only related to commercial asbestos and did not go into the particulates that hang around the taconite industry. We have dealt with the issue of dust in the taconite industry for many, many years, not knowing what's in the dust, just that it's generally just dust. But it clearly is rock dust. It has got a number of minerals in it, and some of those respirators stop and others respirators don't stop. So, Madam Chairman, we were disappointed in the study and are still disappointed in the study. And we look forward to working with the Minnesota Department of Health on their new study. We believe it is imperative for the health of those people that we represent in 5 of the 6 mines in northern Minnesota, and even, we care about the non-union facility in Babbitt and in Silver Bay, because at one time we did represent those folks up on the North Shore. And clearly, in our view, if there is something going on with the ore bodies in northern Minnesota, our members and the community in general need to know what is in that airborne material and what we can do to eliminate it or reduce it, so that particularly people going into the work site don't have to worry about developing mesothelioma. I guess if you can't say, you probably shouldn't be talking about it. that deal with mesothelioma or other lung cancers that could be a result of mining. We need to know that. It is important to our members, and it is important to us as a union to do that. And I would request that the Department of Health use Mike Wright, who is the director of our safety department in Pittsburgh, who's got an extensive background in safety and health in the mining industry, and was unable to be here today because of the storms in the Northeast. So one of the last things that we are very concerned about is that once the study is concluded, because if you take a look at what happened at the IRRRB study, and if you take a look at what happened with the Minnesota Department of Health study, those individuals are not identified. And as you suggested earlier, Madam Chair, their occupational history is not part of this study. We don't know where those people went. We don't know which part of the range or northeastern Minnesota where they worked. We don't know which facility they were at. And by not knowing that information, you don't know what type of rock or what type of minerals that are in that rock that they would have been subject to. So we think it's extremely important that those folks be identified and that a record be kept of their occupational work history. And so as they move, or if they move from the mining industry into some other industry, and the mesothelioma develops some 30 or 40 years after they've left a particular work environment, that we would be able to trace that back and not relate the current illness or the current lung problem to something that had happened in their recent history, when it in fact could have developed in their earlier work history. So thank you for inviting me, Madam Chair, and if there's any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gottlach. I do want to ask you a question about your dissatisfaction with the study that Dr. Bender did. You said that it was clear that it was going to be very limited. Did you try to talk with Dr. Bender or the folks there about your concerns and what happened?
There is a, Madam Chair, there is a document from the Minnesota Department of Health, and I will leave a copy with you, that has dialogue in the committee before the final results of the report were going to be released. And you can tell by that dialogue that amongst those of us that were working in the facilities, that there was a concern that it didn't go into the study didn't go far enough, and it didn't go into the minerals that were found in the ore body. And the last comment that is made by the safety chairman of United of Evlipacinite at that time just specifically says, his name is Paul Hiroshak, and he said, I would like in the future, if they would study the dust that is in these plants, to find out if it does contain asbestos, being that asbestos is the primary cause of this disease. And there clearly were discussions in the committee as to why the study didn't go further than just the commercial asbestos.
And Mr. Bradley, what is the date of that?
I don't believe it has a date on it.
Can you give me the approximate time when you, in the, this is the 2003 study, is this as it was being concluded, or?
As it was being concluded, that's correct. There's also, I also have, Madam Chairman, the Ortis News Volume Number 4, that's dated December 2001, that goes further and talks a bit more about the limited study that was done, and that it was it appears that it was strictly related to commercial asbestos and was never intended to go past commercial asbestos.
And can you tell me what explanation was given to you, Mr. Rutledge, by Dr. Bender or others about why they were not willing to look at the current occupation of those?
Well, as a result,
excuse me,
Madam Chair, but as I recall, it did have to do with funding. It did have to do with the Department of Health, I believe, running out of money. And, you know, some of those issues that we went through in the state, you know, with previous governors.
So I understand you were told there's no money to do this study and it's going to only be focused on other occupational exposure.
Yeah, Madam Chairman, you know, I'm not a scientist, so I don't know whether or not the first exclusion for something like mesothelioma comes with commercial asbestos. I just don't know what that protocol would be. But it clearly never went beyond commercial asbestos.
Madam Chair.
Chairman Rucavina.
Mr. President. Bob used to be the president of Local 1938.
Of your local union, that's right.
What have the steel workers done as far as any types of studies or helping to try to get to the bottom of this?
We haven't been involved, Madam Chairman, Representative Rupervino, we have not been involved to any degree on our own with studies in the United States on mesothelioma or lung-related illnesses. We have been involved with studies in the province of Ontario in Canada over that exact issue, and in fact, I believe there is a forum going on sometime in May in Sudbury. We've set up clinics there that only deal with occupational lung disorders. So we are involved to some degree in Canada, but we don't have that involvement here in the United States.
Madam Chair and Mr. Bartolich, maybe you could refresh my mind on the 1973, I believe, shutdown of Silver Bay ordered by Miles Lord because of these kinds of fibers that were being dumped into the lake.
Representative Hunley, Madam Chair, I can try to do that. I can give you my version and my recollection of what occurred up on the North Shore, but clearly I would not try to, you know, substitute what I know or what I knew for Judge Lord's decision. The issue, as I recall it, on the North Shore was there was taconite tailings that were being dumped directly into Lake Superior. And as a result of that, there were asbestos-like fibers that were getting into the City of Duluth's water supply, and that its current water filtration system was not able to take that out. The hearing on the North Shore, as I recall, the argument or the discussions that went on for weeks and weeks was whether or not it was asbestos fiber or asbestos-like fiber. Geologically, I don't know the difference. But Judge Lord, in his infinite wisdom, found that it was an asbestos-like fiber, as I recall, and that it was detrimental to the citizens of Duluth because of it being into their water supply, and ordered the shutdown of that facility. The shutdown of that facility lasted for a day. It was immediately appealed to the Eighth Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit overruled Judge Lord and reopened the facility the following day. As I understand it, Judge Lord's ruling left some items behind that the appellate court did not deal with. One of those being is that the airborne fiber count in the Silver Bay area can be no greater than the airborne asbestos-like fiber count in the St. Paul area. And for a period of time, that was studied. Then it was stopped. And now, over the last 2 years, it has again been reinstituted, I believe, by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, who as recently as, I think, a couple of weeks ago, found that the airborne asbestos-like fibers in the air in Silver Bay are three times greater than what they are in the St. Paul area that Judge Lord set out the parameters to. So that's basically what I know about the Silver Bay. Other than to say that with the order of going to an on-land disposal system, ARMCO and LTV, who were the owners of that property at that time, invested an additional $360 million into that facility to update it to the most recent technology available in the mid-70s, and that investment has allowed that plant to remain operational much longer into the future than, in my view, it otherwise would have gone.
Thank you.
Just one final question. Did you have a question? Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Madam Chair, maybe nobody has the answer to this, but we've talked about a number of different studies, and we've talked about why the long-term effect of those studies kind of dwindled. There was lack of funding. How much have the studies that have already been done? What were their costs, and what kind of dollars are we talking about? And when funding ran out, what kind of dollars would it have taken to continue those funding? I'm looking at what we're talking about here. We're talking about two new studies, one for $750,000 to $1 million, another one for $250,000. And I'm just trying to understand what kind of dollars were lacking that stopped the progress of the previous inquiries into this.
Madam Chair, to that point,
sure.
I don't know if Mr. Bratledge can comment on that, but I think Mr. Bender or someone from the Health Department, Representative Easton, could comment. My recollection, it was a similar dollar amount we're talking about here, but and we did put in state law an appropriation over a number of years, but I just can't, my, you know, I'm just, like I said, I only remember the grudges now. I'm getting old, so I don't actually remember the facts anymore. So, Representative Bender, or Mr. Bender, I should say. Dr.
Bender.
Yes, Dr. Bender.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, the University of Minnesota spent about $450,000 in 1982 dollars to establish that cohort, and I believe it was paid for by the IRRRB. Those three activities, which I described when I was up here last, were we were spending $250,000 a year on an ongoing basis.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Bender, what you're saying is that $250,000 was not available. I'm not sure if that. Maybe you could address the question raised by Mr. Bratledge, which is they had requested that there be a broader study, and they. I believe you were quoted, or someone associated with you was quoted as saying, well, there's not money for that. We can't really look into the issue of the people working in the mine. We're only going to look at other commercial exposures. What would that have cost, and was that ever discussed with the legislators from up there or the union? Or?
Madam Chair, committee members, Representative Rukavina, actually, the facts here are a little bit out of sequence. The facts are that the initial focus, as I've indicated, was on commercial asbestos. We had from the beginning recognized that the underlying and burning question relative to mesothelioma was taconite dust. We intended to get there, but first had to conduct this activity in order to be able to determine that if the mesotheliomas were related to mining occupations, what part of the mining occupation was it related to? Was it the actual mining and working with the ore itself, or was it with other ancillary processes that occur within the mining industry? And we have, like I said, over 50 people involved in that, and I want to make a point that we had developed detailed occupational histories, not only from the University of Minnesota cohort, but from an interview of over 300 individuals through the protocols developed by our work groups to determine exactly what occupational experiences these individuals had. So, but that's a form of a special study that was conducted in the concert of this. So if we had had the continued funding, I think it's fair to say we would have the answer to the question now.
Madam Chair,
I just want to... Oh, did you want to finish your question?
Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, I'm just kind of going back. You said in 1982 there was about $450,000 that was a study that was done that was kind of funded at that time, and then you referred to this $250,000 per year of ongoing funding that was at some point, was that ongoing since 1982? Did that, no. Explain how that worked, what funding flow was going in here.
Madam Chair, Representative Ruth Cavina, the university conducted their activities with funding from the IRRRB, which directly, ours was a ongoing appropriation starting in around, I have it right here, but it's much later than that.
2000?
Let me look, so I don't want to misspeak here.
Mr. Butlich knows. No? Oh, okay.
No.
Let's see, we feel about the year 2000 or 1999, somewhere in that vicinity. So we had funding for about 3 to 4 years.
Madam Chair, could I follow up one more time?
Follow up, Mr. Leeson.
What happened between those two periods of time? Between the 82 kind of study and bringing it back to the service in 2000. I guess what I'm looking at is kind of the relatively small amount of money that's been going into this pool, and the resources of the number of players that are directly affected by this. I just heard you mentioned, sir, that the Silver Bay plant made a $360 million improvement back in 1970, in the 70s, to kind of upgrade. We've got steelworkers unions, we've got thousands of people that are members, we've got the Minnesota Department of Health, we've got all kinds of people, the IRRRB, the 21st Century Mineral Fund, there's tons of funding sources, and we have a relatively small amount of money here that was being used for this purpose, and I just don't understand why there wouldn't be some coordination of that and some ability to move this forward when it affects people, I think, as significantly as we're hearing that it affects them. So that's a comment. I don't know if you want to comment back or not.
Madam Chair, can I comment back on that? I don't know about the earlier studies. All I do know is that in statute there is an allowance for spending taconite tax dollars going to the IRRRB to study the health of miners, and that's where that initial money must have come from. That, you know, is before my time, but I do recall Dr. Bender coming to the range delegation and talking about, he must have been researching that study, that initial study at the university, and that there was an alarming rate of this type of cancer or predecessor to it up in northeastern Minnesota, and they wanted to do research on what's going on. So we did initially get that state money then at that time, but, you know, you have to understand something about our landlords from out east, the mining companies, the robber barons, as we used to call them early on. They don't give anything. Representative Lane's from Hibbing, I believe, and other members around the table understand. They don't give anything back to the community. So if you think they're going to give money to do a study that's unbiased, I think you're sadly mistaken. Now, what they gleaned from their study at Cleveland Cliffs will be interesting to note if they even share it with the Department of Health. But the 21st Century Minerals Fund cannot be used for that. It says in statute what it can be used for. The steelworkers have problems of their own. They've got hundreds of thousands of members that have been laid off, lost their health insurance, lost their pensions. They've got those types of things to take care of for their members. So finding the money for this has never been easy. And then I think in the end, not only did we have the crisis of the 2002 session where we knew what was coming down the pike, and you were a victim of it at your study, Dr. Bender, but you know, we also had some arguments between the steelworkers and the Department of Health that I think ended up probably just everybody throwing their hands in the air and walking away with it after the excuse was that the Ventura administration said, we need money and we're going to take it from here. I think Mr. Bradlich has made it perfectly clear that the steelworkers want to get to the bottom of this. You know, there's this perception that these new people that you found are all miners, which my understanding, talking now three times to the Department of Health, is not known yet. They could be Conwed workers in Cold Bay, they could be wherever, but I think Representative Clark's concern that we have to start tracking this, and I think Dr. Bender's initial concern, which was to set up this occupational respiratory disease thing eventually statewide, I think it's something we really should take a look at. And that, and speaking of that, you know, you did change in my history, my recollection is right. We had something in statute, and then you kind of changed it in a health committee and made it more statewide, where we thought we were focusing on northeastern Minnesota, and then we got in a little, you know, contest, we'll call it, over that. So that's my recollection, Dr. Bender. But remember that argument we had in my office about you changing a few words in the health committee after it had come? We had an initial agreement. So all of that stuff Representative Eastland entered into this whole bunch of rigmarole that we're in now.
Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Probably to Mr. Bradlich, you had mentioned the study that was going on in Canada, that they were getting ready to hold a quorum or investigation in up there. Do you have interface with those steel workers up there that you can glean for that, from that information? It would seem to me that for steel workers at large, this would be something that crosses national borders, and that we would be able to get the information from them as to what their findings are, so we don't have to repeat the same type of studies or same type of investigations.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative, I think the difficulty is, from my limited knowledge of the geology, is that the fibers that are in the ore are significantly different from area to area, and thereby what may be happening in Canada may not be happening in the U.S. because the materials in the ore are different. Now, we do have interface with them. In fact, I don't recall, but I believe it's around May 10th, we have got computer access to this day-long seminar that's going to be put in Sudbury that's dealing with and how they've dealt with lung disorders and occupational lung disease in the province of Ontario. And I believe it's directly related to the zinc and nickel mine that's in Sudbury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay.
Just one final thing before you leave the witness stand, and I heard you make a specific request to the health department. Actually, Dr. Bender, I'd like to ask you to come back down for just a moment, please. And that request is that I think there was a very specific request that the health department work with the steel workers' safety expert, Mike Wright. And I guess I heard you mention earlier that when you put this group together, it included labor, but I have learned that specifically there was a request in those that year that the group was, that you were working with them, that they specifically request that Mr. Wright be part of the discussion and that their labor be at the table, and that was refused. Today it's being requested again, and so I guess I'd just like to get a commitment today whether or not you're going to, and if you're the person who's deciding, that we have an opportunity, that the steel workers have an opportunity to have their voice heard in the way that they request.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, I have here the copy of the report that we released in November 2003, and there's at least 20 labor representatives in this process, including a industrial hygienist from every major labor group. And they were, I think one of the problems we're having in recall is that this was a large group activity. There was an overall ORDIS advisory committee, I'm blocking the name, sir, which you were involved with.
Yes.
And then there was the technical advisory committee, which was the group that was giving us direction on day-to-day action for the study that we're talking about right now. The two were a little bit somewhat separated, and so we might not know exactly what was going on with each for everybody, but we did. And it was called the Exposure Assessment Panel Participation, and I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 union representatives on that. So, yes, in answer to your question, we're very sensitive to the importance of input from everybody in this because, in fact, if we don't deliver something that everybody buys into, we've done nothing. And so, and the answer to your second question is, of course, yes.
Second question being that you would be willing to honor their specific request. Is that my second question that you're responding to?
Absolutely. That's already in the in the process. But one point I want to make additionally, if I have this opportunity, is that a statement was made that I need to correct. We know that every one of those 52 individuals are minors or former minors. In 2 to 3 months' time, we'll be able to produce, because it's necessary for the development of the research protocol to submit to the federal government, a detailed breakdown of these miners within the limitation of the Data Practices Act. Where they worked, how long they worked, what time of jobs they had, those kinds of things. But again, the only limiting factor is the Data Practices Act. You can't be too specific or you're identifying an individual, and that's a violation of law.
Okay. We have a couple other questions. Representative McNamara?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I just want to make a real quick comment. About the time Representative Rukavina and I were both starting our college career at UMD, I remember taking a college class when the college professor was so proud of the fact that our water at the city of Duluth was clearer coming and better to drink coming right out of Lake Superior than Cleveland, Ohio's water was after it was filtered. And a year later, we were totally engulfed in a discussion or engaged in a discussion about how unsafe our water was. So my point is that it's interesting how time changes so fast. And I have a couple of questions. One, Representative Rukavina, it would be easy for me to point and say, my goodness gracious, why wouldn't IRRRB have stayed involved in this? But I think that would be very unfair because I believe IRRRB, was it not set up more to be an economic tool to that the thoughts that the taconite industry might be short-lived and we could use this money for other things? Wouldn't it be wrong to say, well, you should have taken some of that money to use to study the safety? I mean, I hear that question asked, and I'm wondering if that's really a fair question. That's my first question, Madam Chair, and I guess if we could do that first. I'm just curious. I don't know the history, Representative Rubin. Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, the IRRRB did fund the $450,000, I believe, that you heard about at the University of Minnesota. And in statute, it's one of the things they can spend their money on, but the main objective of the agency is to try to find jobs for the area because of the cyclical nature of the of mining and the fact that we thought this ore would run out in about, well, that's why it was called the 2002 fund, because we thought the ore was going to run out in 2002, that it would get so deep that it would be uneconomical to mine, but that's not the case. There's probably another 25, 50, who knows, hundreds of years if we still have a planet of ore left. But the main goal in the statute is to diversify the economy and provide jobs. I'm certainly very, you know, interested in, and in fact we have used money for studies on miners' health. But the agency is there for everybody in northeastern Minnesota and on the Iron Range, not just the taconite miners themselves. We have statutory ability to use that money, some of our money, for doing this, and we have done it in the past, and that's not to say we wouldn't do it in the future.
Madam
Chair, I have one other question. I'm wondering if Mr. Stein or could come back up, and actually I noticed that Representative Rukavina referred to him as Dr. Stein, and I'm wondering if he's been testifying earlier and I didn't realize that you either are a medical doctor or have a doctorate.
His first name is Frank.
Oh.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, thank you for clarifying. I'm not a doctor. In fact, I'm just the director of a division. So I have a number of highly qualified PhD members of my staff that work on these issues. So they're the source of the real knowledge and expertise on this subject. I'm the director of the division.
Well, Director Stein, my point is, and Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, my point is we have been successful in the Eastern Metro in identifying that 3M Manufacturing has been responsible for some unfortunate situations, and I believe have held them responsible financially, morally, ethically, all of that, and will continue to hold them to the fire. My question is, why are we not doing that on the Iron Range? Why are we not? I know they've had some turnover and some stuff, but history should tell us, and I would say Representative Rukavina was nice. He could have used other words.
these folks from the eastern end of the Great Lakes have not been as friendly to northeastern Minnesota as maybe 3M has. So I would think the warning would be that you have things like the remediation fund and stuff. Does it not apply up here? Do we need to tweak some laws? Representative Eastland and I were looking at each other. I mean, the union kicks in a little, IRRRB kicks in a little, but the bulk of this money should come from these folks that have been taking the money and taking it back to Ohio and Pennsylvania. I got some big mansions there and some hunting lodges and stuff they're spending the money on. Maybe take care of my wife's best friend, who dad did die, Representative Rukavina. Worked at, I believe, Erie. Is that the one east of Boabic where they live?
Representative McNamara, do you need anything in my bill?
No. Representative Rukavina, you and I have the history of both coming from families that work for a living, whether it's in the manufacturing plant at 3M at the Chemelite plant, or, as I said, my wife's best friend living in Boabic, whose dad worked, I believe, is Erie the one that's to the east side? He worked at Erie. He died of this a couple of years ago. This is unfortunate, and I don't understand how we're so successful down here. They are our friends up on the Iron Range, even though maybe politically, Rukavina, Representative Rukavina and I don't agree on everything. Deer stands especially, Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, just to the question of what's different between groundwater contamination in the East Metro area and 3M's responsibility or response to that situation as opposed to the iron mining situation. In the case of groundwater contamination, we're dealing with a different set of laws. That's the state Superfund statutes that deal with the disposal of materials at dump sites. And that law was written to address those historic activities that have resulted in environmental contamination. Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is the expert on that, but the law does provide a process by which those historic activities of dumping industrial waste, so forth, can then be remediated, and the responsibilities for cost recovery can be addressed by the state in that process. This is a little separate activity. What we're dealing with in terms of the mining activities and regulation of the mining activities, the ongoing permitting decisions made by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and the adequacy of the information that we use to advise them on setting their air emission standards, for example. One of the studies we want to conduct, and the second study that we referenced today, is to put ourselves in a better position of being able to set regulatory standards for air emissions. I believe Mr. Bradley talked about the Judge Lord's decision, which set up a process by which the air in Silver Bay is compared to the air in a reference city like St. Paul, I believe is what the judge's decision says. And that's a relative standard, meaning as air gets cleaner or dirtier in one place, it can get cleaner or dirtier in the other place. And what we want to be able to do with the study we're talking about conducting is to evaluate these airborne emissions, the materials from the mining fragments that compose the air, some of the particulate matter in the air, so we can help identify a regulatory standard that's tied to health-based effects. We do that through traditional risk assessment methods, looking at animal-based studies and then transferring that into human exposure. So that's just another way of reminding you what the second study was for. But you were correct. The laws that apply in the East Metro area don't apply to the mining industry in this
situation. We have a witness that has to leave, so Representative...
My only follow-up would be, Representative Rukavina, there might be some need that I have in your bill, and it might be due to the fact that we shouldn't be treating Iron Range different than the East Metro.
Okay, Representative McNamara, I just want to say one thing. We haven't exactly held 3M accountable yet. I think the goal is, and you've been one of the voices for that, but we haven't seen that happen yet, so let's hope we can do it for the job as you're projecting we will. I want to thank you very much for coming, and I do have a witness who needs to leave, and so I'm going to skip out of order of what we have here and ask for Dr. Ian Greaves to come forward and talk a little bit about occupational health-related research and cancer. Welcome to the committee. If you introduce yourself, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Rucavina, members of the committee, my name is Ian Greaves. I am an occupational environmental medicine physician specializing in lung diseases. I've been working in the field of occupational health and safety for about 30 years. I've seen a lot of things happen over that time. A lot of changes have happened, but unfortunately asbestos has been there all of that time. And in response to a couple of questions that came up about the adverse health effects of asbestos, asbestosis is a disease that is a scarring disease in the lung itself. It eliminates parts of the lung, it reduces the amount of air that can come into the lungs, and it's a form of slow suffocation. Mesothelioma is a rare tumor of the outside surface of the lung, of the pleural surface of the lung. Unfortunately, it occurs at relatively low levels of exposure to asbestos, and that's why it is the condition that most people fear. It's actually the one that occurs at the lowest level of exposure, and so the smallest amount of exposure can cause that disease. And there are other problems. Lung cancer, bronchogenic carcinoma of the lung, very common in people who are exposed to asbestos and smoke. And then a benign condition, thickening of the outside surface of the pleura, a scarring, but not a malignant change. And that's particularly common, and I think one of our previous testifiers mentioned pleural thickening. In regard to taconite contains fibers. They're not asbestos fibers mineralogically, but they are fibers that resemble asbestos in terms of their shape. Not all taconite is made up of fibers, but there are some fibers present. And what we've learned over the last 15 or 20 years about asbestos and other fibers is if we have a fiber that looks like asbestos in terms of its length and diameter and stays around in the lungs for several years like asbestos does, it will indeed cause exactly the same adverse health effects. So asbestos and asbestiform materials can indeed produce exactly the same problems, including mesothelioma. And that's the question here. Do the fibers that are present in taconite also cause mesothelioma? Animal studies help a little bit, and they've shown that many, many different types of fibers, apart from asbestos, can indeed cause mesothelioma. But the unknown here is to what extent is taconite over and above some incidental asbestos exposure likely to be causing a problem? You know, and if we'd had good occupational history data on these workers going way back, we'd be in a good position to answer some of these questions today with some of the additional information that Dr. Bender is talking about. The Thai workplace job titles to specific exposures. That's the link epidemiologically that provides science beyond the routine surveillance. And I think we've learned over the last 30 years that the workplace is a potential source of cancer. Going beyond asbestos, we've learned that there are agents in the workplace that might conceivably contribute to breast cancer and leukemia and lymphoma and brain tumors, and so the list goes on. And I've heard a reluctance to accept that inserting work histories into a cancer registry is a desirable thing. I've heard that nobody does it. Well, it may be difficult to do. It's not easy, it's time consuming, but I do believe it's information that's long overdue in many registries, not just the cancer registry, birth registries, other types of registries, other surveillance programs. And we've been missing out by not including that information. Today, 25 years after that first study in 1982, we're still asking the same questions about mesothelioma and lung disease on the Iron Range. And that's an awful long time to leave questions unanswered. And I realize there have been funding issues and so on. But I do believe that if we increase the amount of information we routinely collect, especially work histories, we'll be in a better position to answer these questions quicker and more reliably than by having to go back and do more studies again and again. It's like we've never finished with this issue, and this is one of the best studied issues in the state around cancer. How many issues are going by the board simply because we don't know what people do in their work or what they're exposed to? And with that, I'd like to close, Madam Chair, and I'd welcome any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. Greaves, who is a medical doctor?
Yes, I am.
Doctor, were you part of that initial study?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, I was not.
Did you flood the basement?
Representative Rukavina, I did not. I wouldn't do that today.
Well, I really appreciate your testimony, and I know that you have to leave, so thank you very much for making time in your schedule today to come in.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Back to the schedule. Jennifer Schaubach from AFL-CIO, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Rupavina, and members of the committee. I appreciate the chance and the opportunity to come before you and testify in favor of this legislation. Many studies have been done to identify the relationships between workplace environment and incidence of mesothelioma, and we feel that Minnesota should follow suit. A representative, I'm not sure, I think he left the room, was talking about the studies in Canada, which ironically I have some statistics from. One study called Five Deaths a Day, Workplace Fatalities in Canada, 1993 to 2005, found that workplace fatalities are climbing. For example, in 2005, they climbed to 1,097 fatalities compared to only 958 in 2004. Out of the deaths in 2005, 491 were accidents, while 557 of them were caused by diseases related to occupation. More than 30%, or 340 of these deaths, were asbestos-related, a big jump from fewer than 60 asbestos-related deaths a decade earlier. And that study was conducted by the Ottawa-based nonprofit organization, Center for Study of Living Standards. There has been a widespread exposure to asbestos by workers within shipyards, mines, and mills, producers of asbestos products, workers in the heating and construction industries, and other tradespeople, and an increased risk of developing mesothelioma has been a result. The risk of asbestos-related disease increases with heavier exposure to asbestos and longer exposure time. However, some individuals with only brief exposure have been developing mesothelioma. Family members and others living with asbestos workers have an increased risk of developing mesothelioma and possibly other asbestos-related diseases. The risk may be the result of exposure to asbestos dust brought home on clothing and hair of asbestos workers. The statistics are frightening. Every year, as many as 65,000 American workers develop pulmonary disorders related to their workplace environment. Around 25,000 die every year from such diseases. And it's not only workers in mining industries that are at risk from exposure to asbestos. Until the 1970s, the product was used in insulation, ventilation systems, concrete, and other commercial products. Automotive mechanics may be exposed to asbestos in brake pads, and construction workers may find it in insulation on pipes and inside walls and ceilings. As a result, workers in the trade and transport industry have the highest number of deaths, accounting for almost half of all work-related fatalities from 1996 to 2004. Mesotheliomas begin to appear 15 to 20 years after asbestos exposure and are seen in greatest profusion 25 to 35 years afterward. They are rapidly fatal, claiming the lives of 5 to 10% of all insulation workers. The study reports that asbestos-related deaths are not expected to peak until 2010 to 2020. I certainly hope you all support this legislation to create a statewide cancer surveillance system to reduce future incidents of this fatal disease in our workplaces and communities. Thank you for your time, and I will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Michelle. I just should correct you. We don't have a specific piece of legislation on mesothelioma.
Mm-hmm.
What you are referring to is a discussion we've had around including occupational data in our cancer registry. So thank you for that support.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate that. Did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Any questions from members? Ms. Amador, I realized you had your hand up a while ago, and I'm not sure, maybe it was one of a previous witness, and I just missed you. Do you want to come?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and actually it's more for the historical value of the committee here. I have a couple of things. First of all, again, relating to your to the cancer surveillance, the accumulation of this data, as you know, several times I've spoken about the fact that I have two children with disabilities, and one of them in particular is going back and trying to figure out were there exposure situations where this may have caused these disorders. And the aggregate collection of all this data to be available for scientists maybe 10, 15 years down the road is vitally important for us to be able to determine where some of these exposure points would be. So again, I'm as you know, in support of that database collection. But the other thing is that I remember several years ago, and maybe people can help me here, when Congressman Bento died.
Yes.
And I remember that there was a lot of press on that, and we talked about the impact in Minnesota and where some of these jobs are. I don't remember whether or not he was a miner. I don't believe he was. I think he lived all his life in St. Paul and worked there. But I, as a consumer or a taxpayer at that point, was under the impression that we took some action here at the Capitol and that we were starting to look at tracking these instances so that we were prepared should there be an onslaught. Now, I'm just wondering, I don't have any historical data for this, and unfortunately I didn't have enough time to do some historical research before coming to the committee, but perhaps committee members that have been here for several years, you can explain to me what, I believe he died in 2001 or 2002. It was, and then I'm hearing that we stopped the study, so I'm confused.
Okay.
From the historical perspective on that.
Before we get into that, I just want to mention we have one more witness, and I wasn't sure if it was your question was for a witness. I think your question is very, very important. I wonder if we could have our last witness, and then let's have that discussion. I think it would be good, and we can certainly talk about Congressman Bento's exposure and what happened. I have to know a little bit about that. Dr. Vincent Gary, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
You introduce yourself, please.
I'm Dr. Vincent Gary. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Medical School in the Department of Lab Medicine and Pathology, former Director of the Environmental Medicine and Pathology Lab at the University, co-director of the Toxicology Program at the University of Minnesota, retired Colonel of the U.S. Army, Board Directors of the American Board of Toxicology. But other than that, I think the previous witnesses have taken much of the thunder and lightning that I can talk to you about. But I'd like to kind of fill in the cracks there a little bit. Mesothelioma, as you know, and I have learned, is a relatively rare form of cancer that occurs commonly in certain occupations, and mostly in mining. And we know that it takes just a little tad bit of vestas to produce it. It doesn't follow the typical dose response curve that we get with asbestosis and or bronchial cancer. That is mineral fiber times time gives you a relative risk of asbestosis or of lung cancer. Doesn't work with mesothelioma. Can be incidental exposure. And the most terrible part of mesothelioma is that we, in terms of chemotherapy and in terms of treatment of this disease, it's not very treatable. And the patients die usually within 2 years. So that's very unfortunate. Now, you can imagine if you then have to go through each time, and once the diagnosis has been made, and then you wait until a patient dies until you find out something about their occupation. Wouldn't it be good if once the diagnosis was made, that you found out something about their occupation, what they did for a living, how long they've done it, you know, what's their past history? Could we do that? Is that possible? I think there are other states that do some remedial occupational inclusion in their cancer registry, for instance, Iowa. There are some countries which from cradle to grave find out about occupations of their inhabitants. Most of your Scandinavian countries, including Sweden, find this out. There are countries like Great Britain that also does this. There are countries like Italy which do this. But we don't. And I wonder why. What is it about occupation that is so hazardous to our health that we can't possibly find out something about what a guy did for a living? So it's really, really relatively surprising in this day and age that we can't figure this out. I think it's time to start. Thank you. Any questions?
Representative Mahoney.
Just to let's tie in a little bit with Representative Minador's question. Bruce Vento, his history, as best as I was able to hear or find out, was that he spent a number of summers cleaning copper kettles and doing maintenance at a brewery. And very minimal exposure. So his would be months rather than years as a miner or a construction worker dealing with asbestos exposure. And what would that tell us? I mean, one person has months and another person has years. Same particular issue at the end. They develop a lung cancer of some sort, one fashion or another. I mean, and what does that information tell us?
Dr. Gary.
All right. Well, now let's see if we can get a little clarification here. For asbestos-related diseases like asbestosis and asbestos-related cancer, there's a well-defined dose response curve. Unfortunately or fortunately, in terms of fiber and time. It takes so many fibers for so long a period of time to develop lung cancer X. For mesothelioma, this whole supposition fails. It's very peculiar. One of the things that I've not heard is in the current situation up in northeastern Minnesota, how come we haven't heard of a concomitant rise in asbestosis and of asbestos-related lung cancer in that area? Why is that absent? Or is there information that needs to be developed? If not, we've got a relatively unique situation then where we have an asbestiform fiber which is capable of producing, we think, mesothelioma. To find out more about that is basically the question that we have. And yes, you're right that it takes just a wee tad and it can be an incidental situation, but for 80% of the time, we're pretty sure of the relationship. For 20%, we're not.
Did that complete your question? Okay. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Gary, when I hear a question like the one you asked, why we can't do a historical study, I always ask myself whether we ought not to follow the money. And the reason I ask that question is because if we did follow the money, might there not be some significant financial consequences for those industries who may be involved in these kinds of activities which are leading to these health problems for their employees?
Boy. That's a relatively loaded question.
Is it really?
Let me widen the thing a little bit here first. Yeah. There are a number of cancers which we think have an occupational relationship with, which Dr. Greaves mentioned, you know, a little bit about. For example, where...
Here?
we know about a relationship between vinyl chloride exposure and liver cancer. Well, heck, you know, the French found that out, and so did a few others, and a couple of people in Missouri that were physicians. You know, we figured this thing out. And it's a rare cancer that occurs commonly in the guys dealing with a vinyl chloride. Well, that should be a risk for that industry, and it should be, yeah, follow the money there. And there are a number of issues like that, and that would encourage our industrial partners to be a little bit more careful with their workers and their exposure. That would be a good thing. Bad thing would be, maybe it costs a little bit of money. Maybe we should build a pot of money and do this thing.
Dr. Gary, that brings to mind something that I'm familiar with, which is, and I know that you are, which is, right now our own University of Minnesota, professors who want to do studies on various occupational or other kinds of exposures, they have to really go out and be entrepreneurs and get the funding to do that kind of work right now. And we have a National Institute of Health and CDC and others who may be funding sources, but may be influenced by some of those same folks. We've heard a lot of actually scandal and conflict of interest with those two organizations in recent years about that, people who are influencing their determinations of funding. And so I'm just wondering what you might share. I think one of the problems with our failure to look at occupational health and safety is that we don't have independent funding in our universities like we used to have. Scholars could do independent research. They're pretty much, a lot of them have to go and apply for funding at our national institutes and with companies who may be the sources of the funding and not want to necessarily, don't necessarily appreciate the results that are discovered. If you want to comment on that at all.
A little bit, but this is a public forum here.
It's recorded.
It's recorded. Oh, dear Lord.
You don't have to say anything. You don't prefer. I guess I just...
No. I'll speak to the question as best I can. I sit on the Occupational Environmental Health study section for the National Institutes of Occupational Health and Safety. I also sit on NIH study sections as well. It's been a privilege to do this. There was a period of time which, in the beginning of our Republican administration in Washington, at which the question was raised that I later found out about who was on the study section and who did they vote for. Now, I found that to be kind of a bit much, and I soon disappeared from study section for a while, but I've been resurrected in the last 2 years. And now I'm back on the study section, and the study section has been revived. We try in study section at NIH and NIOSH to be impartial in our granting. Now, one of the issues that comes up very continuously is that there is always the case of the haves and the have-nots. But what I mean by that is that the Johns Hopkins, the Harvards, the University of California have the tools, the techniques, the people, the money, and whatever to go execute a grant. Some of the other individuals don't have this, and it shows that they don't have the tools, the techniques, and the money to execute much of anything. So the money tends to go to the haves. That's one of the other issues that we run into, but we can't help that. These are the people that have the stuff that we need to do things. The politics that comes in has been, in recent years, moderated, very recently. But there has been political influence early on in this administration, and it seems to be dampening down at this point. hopefully. And I guess that's about all I'll say on that.
You know, committee members, we kind of ran out of time. Representative Madure, did you want to make any final comments? I asked you to wait briefly, and I...
No, I guess I'm looking forward to that historical perspective a bit, because, again, I thought that after his death there was an awful lot of media attention to this disease and developing factors of it, and, again, I assumed that we had put in place studies to look at this, and if I'm finding that out now, I think we need to fix that. So that's just my... I just wanted to hear a historical perspective on it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. And
Representative
Moore has one. Oh, Representative
Moore, thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Rukavina, I also think it's interesting for the committee to remember that the state of Minnesota closed the OSHA offices in northern Minnesota and on the range and in Bemidji. And Chair Rukavina has sought to restore those offices in his bill, which we appreciate. But that, I find it pretty interesting that those offices are no longer in operation, which might pertain to Representative Benson's question. You know, what are we worried about? What are we worried about finding?
Well, I want to thank committee members today from both committees for attending. I want to thank the Health Department, and I think hopefully we've begun a discussion on this issue of not only mesothelioma, but the whole occupational tracking of cancer and other diseases. And I think I saw a hand go up over here. Representative Peterson?
Thanks, Madam Chair.
Just one moment, please, members, before you leave.
Since we've spent an hour and a half and gotten some great information, what's the travel log of this discussion? Where's it going?
But Representative Peterson, I consider it, I'll speak for myself, it was helpful today to hear some of the discussion. It's helpful to go through some of the history. I think what Representative Madure was talking about is we need to continue to look at that. I think we might want to take a trip up, maybe our committee take a trip up to the Iron Range and have a on-site visit with some of the folks who are dealing with this, if that would be okay with the legislators up there, and see if we can't ensure that some of the resources that we've been talking about that are missing somehow get brought forward, and there may be some other kinds of ways that we want to do that, and then probably it's going to have to wait till the interim, but we'll have to see. And I guess I'm always interested in your advice, and I'm sure Chair Rukavina is too, committee members here, how urgently you want us to go forward with something in this session or wait till the interim. I don't think anything is off the table. I don't know if that answers your question at this point.
Madam Chair, I guess my question was, are you planning on doing something with legislation this session, amending this, or getting it into rules? Do you have a path in mind for...
In terms of mesothelioma?
Mm-hmm, the study.
I think today has given us food for thought, and we'll mull that over in the next few days. We have another month or so that we have to think about this. I don't have a specific thing to share with you today, and I don't know if the Chairman Rukavina does.
Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, I don't either. I came here to listen. I think, there's strong arguments maybe from Representative Madure to resurrect the initial path of what Dr. Bender and those at the Department of Health were trying to do back when it started in late 1999, I think it was, or 2000, when he wanted to, eventually start in northern Minnesota, but expand out to the whole state, from what I understand, with this looking at respiratory diseases in all occupations in the state. So maybe that's the path to go, and this is what's happening in northern Minnesota, since they're seeking federal funding, would be the beginning of resurrecting that study and funding it.
And Representative, just say for myself, I do want to make sure that we keep occupational tracking of cancer and other projects in our not only current legislation, but figure out ways that we can build on that if need be. Okay, with that, if there's no further discussion, all those are the committee's adjourned.